and by. Just move on up toward your destination. Though you may find from time to time complication.
Hi everyone, I'm Nicole and you're listening to All Access Pass, a show brought to you by the Accessibility Collective at CITR 101.9 FM. We are broadcasting live from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land of the Musqueam people. Happy New Year! I hope all you folks listening had a really restful winter break. For today's episode, we have Sam back on. Sam has been on a few episodes already and I'm stoked to have her back. How was your break, Sam?
It was good. I slept so much, which was like the one goal I had for the break, so it was awesome.
Oh, that's so wonderful. What a good feeling. How was getting home? Because you're not from Vancouver, right?
Yeah, actually, I got lucky. All the flights were canceled, but I was on the 24th, so the Saturday, so my flights were all good, although they were busier than usual because everyone who missed the flight was trying to get into our flight.
Yeah, I am very grateful that I like never have to deal with airport stress.
From here. How was your break, by the way?
It was wonderful. I think I finished my last exam and like just collapsed for 3 days straight. Then I was like, wow, this is so wonderful. Like, I don't have to do anything except relax, really.
My favorite job ever is the one where I don't have to do anything but relax. So
yeah, I feel you. The first week for me, and I got like weirdly lucky in the sense that I somehow ended up having 3 weeks of break. Because my last exam was on the 18th, which was a Sunday. Yeah, so I had 3 whole weeks of break, which was wonderful. And the first week was really just like, you know, relaxing, not really having to do anything. And the second week, I was like, okay, like I should do something. So I just, you know, worked out. My only goals for each day were just work out for like an hour each day, and it was wonderful. And then by that point, I was kind of like, this is that weird week where like it's after Christmas before New Year's, and like
time isn't real. Nothing's real at that point.
It doesn't help that I live alone. So like I went home, I drove home for like holiday events and family dinners and things, but I was like, I'm slowly losing it. I need things to do.
You sleep for a while and then you're like, I
have no sense of purpose.
Yeah, I need something, like a project or something to do, you know?
I was, like, really hoping to do some pottery on campus, but our studio ended up being closed. Because the student building was closed, but I got some reading in, which was nice.
Start a new book or reread an old one?
I finished The Bell Jar, Sylvia Plath.
Do I know that? I don't think I know that book.
That one is a book about depression about a woman who I think like a fictional character alive in the 50s, I believe. So like really beautiful classic piece of literature. Started a bunch of new books. My Goodreads goal this year is 30 books.
Ooh, yeah, exciting.
I'm down at 3. I'm on track.
That's fantastic.
Yeah,
I made one and forgot the password, but I haven't made a Goodreads because...
It's the best social media. It's all the best parts of social media without any of the BS.
Yeah.
Big fan.
I'd be so afraid that I'd like wouldn't meet my goal and then I'd feel bad. I don't know. Yeah.
My friend was 2 books short and she was so sad about it.
But she
read 78 books this year, which I think is nuts. Big old bookworm.
No kidding. Yeah, that's amazing.
Did you have any New Year's goals that you set for yourself?
I really enjoyed for many years, you know, New Year's goal setting, but I've kind of moved away from it a little bit. I know that lots of people set New Year's goals and they're fantastic and they really motivate them, but I don't know. I have goals, like, you know, but I state them much more generally and I feel like that works better for me. But did you set goals?
Initially I was hoping to just do like 10 minutes of meaningful movement a day. So that
I love that.
Yeah. Cause I feel like I'm a little bit of like a workout perfectionist and I was like, I just want to be able to like go for a 10 minute walk every day. And I think I've missed a few days here and there, but I'm trying not to give up on that and just trying to push forward as I can.
Yeah.
And yeah, totally. I think the thing about goals that is so daunting is you feel this immediate pressure to really commit and dive in. And I'm trying to like move away from that mindset and kind of just be like, this is something I would like to try my best to achieve. And I understand that it won't always be possible, but
yeah, no, I'll keep exactly. at it. Yeah that's I'll kind of that's kind of where I'm at too here. Yeah.
Yeah. Committing to goals is, I think, stressful mm-hmm. for a lot of people. But anyways,
yeah,
I'm really excited to announce today's topic because it kind of prefaces the next three episodes that'll be coming up. So the theme, which was actually spurred as an idea from another collective member, Jack Willis, he suggested doing an episode on language with neurodivergence. And the entire idea was we would talk about kind of the history behind certain words and like why we use certain words and why we don't use certain words. And then we'd have some people who identified with being neurodivergent to come on and talk about their preferences. Like, mm-hmm. do they prefer to use person first language or otherwise, and their reasons for doing so. And I was like, that is a really good idea for many different facets of disability and accessibility.
Mm-hmm.
So the next three episodes are going to be talking about physical and visible disabilities and neurodivergence and also mental illness / health.
Mm-hmm.
And today is kind of like an introduction, if you will, an introduction to disability theory, which I'm really stoked to have Sam on for this particular episode because I think she's like the closest thing we can get to an expert for this. So, Sam, can you remind us about your educational background, please?
Yeah, I'm nowhere near an expert, but I do enjoy learning about this for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I did my undergrad in kinesiology mm-hmm. and it was second year. I had a class. It was adapted physical activity class, mm-hmm. and I really, really enjoyed it. And that kind of that's the reason I'm now here now in a master's in kin, and then kind of specializing in adaptive physical activity and hopefully critical disability studies as I continue in this degree here.
Yeah, I have like. I feel like I've mentioned this before on air, but I feel like I've never thought of kinesiology and disability in the same breath, which
yeah.
it makes sense. It makes sense to me. I've always like viewed disability and accessibility topics in more of kind of like a sociology, anthropology
mm-hmm.
kind mm-hmm. of field, but it definitely like makes a lot of sense that it would be in a kinesiology.
Yeah, totally. Although, I mean, like, you know, they have little sections of kinesiology. So mm-hmm. ours is sociocultural studies. So, okay. like, you're right. You know, it's yeah. definitely sociology, cultural studies, and yeah. all that sort of thing. I kind of think of it like as taking a very difficult topic
mm-hmm.
or a very big topic like disability and accessibility and then carving off a little chunk. So
yeah.
there's massive social problems, you know, ableism, and that's okay. How can we address that? Just this little chunk of it, you know, kind of through kinesiology or mm-hmm. sports and recreation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, like the entire show, our entire show is about
mm-hmm.
accessibility. And I feel like this specific topic kind of spearheads the essence and the spirit of what yeah. accessibility is. So I'm going to start off kind of just by asking you like a really general question. And that is, what is disability theory?
Yes, fantastic place to start.
Yeah.
Disability theory is, so we or sometimes we call it models of disability.
Mm-hmm.
And so a model of disability, it talks about the way that you understand disability in the most general sense. So a model of disability, it encapsulates how you think about disability. It'll, you know, it'll change. It'll influence the language you use to talk about disability. It'll influence how you treat people with disabilities or disabled people. And we'll maybe one of these episodes we'll talk about kind of some of the differences between those two bits. So it's a very general way to understand disability.
Yes. Yeah, I feel like a lot of people, myself previously included, like really did not give the whole concept of disability much of a second thought.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of just like, oh, there are some people that are not considered to be able-bodied. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of just that. And I did not really give it more of a second thought. But being part of the Accessibility Collective and talking to Sam, like, I've kind of learned that there's so many different models of how to view disability. And yeah. disability in itself is just a massive social construct.
Yeah.
As totally. Many things are.
Everything is, if you dig deep enough.
Yeah. So, yeah. like, why does it matter that we have these different models of disability?
Yeah, so fantastic question. Like I kind of said, the way you think about disability has real world consequences. Mm-hmm. So, you know, theories, ideas, some of these philosophies, they don't exist in silos. They don't exist all by themselves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you theoretically may be aligned with this particular theory or this model, but, you know, it doesn't really matter. You know, in the way that you interact with people. But actually, it does. So the reason that, you know, models of disability, the way we think about disability matters is because it influences the way that we treat disabled people. If we're thinking about voting and, mm-hmm. and elections, the way you think about disabled people is going to influence the candidates you vote for, or the lens or the way you understand when if you're asking a political kind of candidate, so what do you think about this? It's going to influence it's hard because it's an understanding that provides the groundwork or the base for so many things that have such, you know, far-reaching consequences. Mm-hmm. And some of them might be, you know, fairly minor, so how do you interact with your neighbor who uses a wheelchair?
Yeah.
And some of them are quite broad, you know. So if you're, you know, I don't know, a political candidate is suggesting a new policy. Mm-hmm. Do you support it or not? Or, you know, do you like it but you want changes? So the reason this all matters so much is because it has such a far-reaching influence on our lives and the way we treat other people.
Yeah. No, mm-hmm. I think one thing that is kind of been something like a topic that's been in my mind more recently is I have a friend that lives in a pretty small town.
Mm-hmm.
And this doesn't necessarily pertain to disability, but she lives in a food desert. Mm-hmm. Which just means that there are no grocery stores in like her immediate vicinity, so she's like take a few buses to get to one, which is like already annoying in itself if you mm-hmm. don't have a vehicle, but then you've got to like consider people who are not able-bodied, and making that trek is significantly more difficult for them.
Yeah.
So for example, like people who are wheelchair bound or mm-hmm. people that have a lot of social anxiety in buses are really difficult for them. It's mm-hmm. a whole process for them.
Absolutely.
And so like, you kind of start to see how little things that you wouldn't think about
yeah.
have a large ripple effect.
Yeah, I was a TA in a class this semester, also a class on mm-hmm. Adaptive physical activity or disability in recreation and leisure. And one of the things that I really loved that this prof talked about is how it was a once a week, I don't know if it was a swimming class or something, mm-hmm. and how a once a week swim class, and maybe swim class itself lasts an hour, mm-hmm. could be a 3 or 4 hour commitment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, talking about if you have a mobility aid and it takes you longer to get to the bus stop,
mm-hmm.
or if you use the accessible transit,
mm-hmm.
In Edmonton it was DART, I can't remember what it's called here right now. You have to pre-book your trips, and they're often late, so you actually have to like plan ahead
yeah.
for the bus to be late. And
yeah.
so and then, you know, once you get to the facility, the pool, it could take you longer to get ready.
Yeah.
You may need to make sure to show up a couple minutes early, for example, if you need to use a lift to help mm-hmm. you get into the water. And so all of these things add up. So a 1 hour swim class, exercise class,
turns
anything
into like a 3 4
is really
hour
a 3 or 4
excursion.
Hour, you know, commitment. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. It's all these things that lots of people don't realize until they suddenly become someone with an impairment, mm-hmm. whether that's temporary or more lifelong, or oftentimes are if they have a family member with a disability.
Yeah, yeah. I think about that a lot. Is and I'm not trying to villainize anyone. Is I feel like a lot of people don't really consider the issues of marginalized groups and those with disabilities, because it's just never something they've had to think about.
Yeah.
And they ask, well, like, why should I care? And I go, well, I think there's like kind of like two arguments, or not arguments necessarily, but two ways to view that. And one of them is, do you care about the human lives of others? And the other one is, this could be you, you know?
Yeah,
like,
totally.
I think it is just a nice, decent human thing to do, to really consider everybody.
Absolutely, yeah. There's some people who, instead of saying, you know, for example, people with disabilities and people without disabilities, or disabled, non-disabled, they'll say, for example, people with disabilities and those who are temporarily able-bodied.
Which Yeah.
Ooh.
Yo, you know what's really bizarre? I read a book more recently called On Vanishing. And it's about dementia. And it's a very interesting form of book. It's kind of like a mix between a memoir with a lot of the author's personal experiences, and more of an informative book with a lot of different facts and like digging into a lot of data and interpreting data, and also like a book about philosophy on how we view the elderly. And that really kind of just ties it together with the point you just made, temporarily able-bodied. Because there is a very real crisis happening worldwide, and the book in particular focuses on the States, America, of people becoming older and needing care and accessible options just to live their day-to-day lives. And they are being shipped off to nursing homes. And nursing homes are not by any means a perfect solution, but the only thing worse than a nursing home would not be having nursing homes. And it really, reading this book really made me think, like, wow, like, you are a functioning member of society, and you offer so much and people care about you. And then one day you are old and you can't make your meals as easily, or remembering things is a little bit more difficult, or you're more prone to falling. And all of a sudden, like, you've kind of been hidden away from the rest of the world by being in a nursing home. And that really opened my eyes and changed my perspective. Is also because I feel like nursing homes are this weird, forbidden land. I don't know if anyone's viewed it this way, but I feel like there is this stigma against nursing homes, and like, they're not a place where people go visit for fun. I don't know, like, that is such an interesting point, temporarily able-bodied, because when you think about it, all of us in our lifetime will experience debilitating illness or some like temporary disability, or we'll just become old.
It's well, I don't know, it would be very rare to manage to live your entire life, you know, without experiencing some sort of impairment or becoming disabled at some point. And, you know, you brought up a really interesting point with dementia and with people growing old, because a lot of people, as they grow older, you know, maybe their hearing isn't as good anymore, or I don't know, they need stronger glasses and that sort of thing. But many people who are older and in that situation don't identify as a person with a disability or disabled.
Which is really interesting.
Isn't it interesting? So
yeah, like, and some people become older and suddenly need walking aids, like wheelchairs or canes, but they don't identify as disabled. They just identify as elderly.
Yeah, actually, there's an interesting, it was a chat earlier this week. There was a professor visiting, I want to say from McGill. He was talking about last year, so 2021 in BC, there was a heat dome, there was a report released more recently about that reported on the deaths, which is unfortunate. And so the report highlighted things like living alone, isolation, and they also specifically highlighted elderly people or older folks who were but due to a variety of reasons, we're more likely to, you know, suffer the ill effects during the heat dome. But this professor said he read through, you know, the report and noticed there was no mention of, you know, another common factor to many of the people who had passed away was that they were disabled. They had a disability. They had an impairment. And so his comment was, oh, that's interesting. Why would you leave, you know, that that bit out in the report? I mean, all systems of oppression are connected. And so you can't separate things like ageism and from other things like ableism. And we can't get into it because the
it's
discussion
so
but it would be
interconnected and complicated yeah. But we are going to go to ad break right now, but when we're back we will discuss some more topics in disability theory. Mm-hmm.
The AMS Sexual Assault Support Centre, the SASC, is a free and confidential service which provides support to those who experience sexual assault, intimate partner violence, and harassment. We provide services to folks of all genders, including students, staff, faculty, and those who have a connection to the UBC Vancouver campus. We provide crisis and short-term emotional support, legal, medical, and campus-related advocacy, and outreach and educational programs. We are located in the Student Nest, room 3130. For more information on our hours of operation and other resources and services, please go to our website, amssasc.ca, or visit our Facebook page, AMS Sexual Assault Support Centre.
About 40% of UBC students experience food insecurity. Sprouts is hosting a weekly produce market from 10:30 to 1:30 every Monday in the Life Building. With produce from local farms, students are free to take whatever they want. Sprouts Cafe is open from Monday to Thursday and is offering 30 free meals a day, completely free and no questions asked. They also host Community Eats, a completely free hot lunch that is open for all. Stop by and support the Sprouts cause for sustainable, accessible food at UBC.
Hi, welcome back. This is Nicole, and you're listening to All Access Pass at CITR 101.9 FM. So we were talking earlier a little bit about disability theory, Sam.
Yeah. And how it influences, you know, kind of everything, all of our actions, our words, and how we interact with other people and society. Mm-hmm. But I want to start this bit by kind of going to throw you under the bus maybe a little bit. But Nicole, tell me, what is disability? You know, if I, what do you think about on the top of your head? How would you define disability?
See, disability is such an interesting thing, such an interesting concept, because I feel like, for me, at least, I am still learning about so many different models and theories about disability that I'm very, like, open-minded in the sense that I'm, like, willing to hear a lot more, and I haven't developed any super strong opinions on one model in particular. But I feel like if you had asked me 6 months ago what disability was, I would have had a very clear-cut answer in mind.
Oh, please,
but now,
please share. Please share.
Now
share,
I don't. Yeah. Now I think disability is a very is a very nuanced thing. I think disability in the past, I would have just been like, oh, like anybody that needs accessibility. Mm-hmm. And now it's in my mind, I'm kind of going, well, is disability someone that anyone that needs accessibility? Like, what if someone doesn't want those accessible, those accessible options? Or what if they do choose them, but they don't like necessarily need them per se, or there are people that would be considered less able-bodied than others but choose not to, whereas someone who is still not able-bodied, like, it's a whole complicated thing. And I think disability, when I think about it now, if you ask what is disability, it is just this whole social construct that we've created as a society of what a quote-unquote normal able-bodied person is. And whoever fits into that model, and then whoever chooses to self-identify as disabled or not able-bodied fits into the category of disability.
Yeah, fantastic. I love some of the things you brought up there. So, you know, different ways we can define disability based on, you know, who needs assistance or who is looking for perhaps an accommodation. But then going, well, what about people who choose not to for various reasons? Or maybe people who, by, you know, by many definitions would fall under the category of disability but don't identify as disabled, or choose to not identify as disabled. I also It's amazing, amazing. I love that you brought up the you know, the idea of disability as a social construct, because yeah that's fantastic.
I mean, like, it's interesting because everything is kind of a social construct.
Oh yeah.
And
oh,
like we focus specifically here on accessibility and disability. Mm-hmm. But when you think about it, like, gender, like, who decided that gender was a strict scientific thing, you know? And even science is a very, like, nuanced discussion and topic.
Oh yeah, like,
everything is incredibly nuanced. Mm-hmm. But anyways, back to disability as a social construct.
Yeah, so, you know, kind of what you brought up there is a little bit in line with, you know, one of two main or very popularized models of disability. So what you were talking about there was, or, you know, that kind of aligns a little bit with the social model. But the easiest way, I think, to understand is to start with the medical model. So the medical model is quite common to lots of people and lots of institutions in our society, like the healthcare system. And it, you know, it kind of says disability means that there's something wrong with you. There's something maybe wrong with your brain or your body or something like that. And, you know, through the wonders of modern medicine and Western medicine, we want to fix it. Mm-hmm. So kind of this idea of disability being something that something individual, something physiology based, and something that needs to be fixed through the medical system. Mm-hmm. So that's the medical model. And yeah, before we get too into some of the other ones, I want to say sometimes people say, let's do away with the medical model, get rid of it. You know, we should use some of these other ones, these, you know, much maybe cooler ones. just a reminder, there is value in the medical model.
Yeah.
All right. If you, you know, you break your arm and you go to the hospital and you're in so much pain and the doctor comes over and says, oh, don't worry. Don't worry, Nicole. Disability is a social construct. And you know, you're not really impaired. You're not disabled. It's all this is gonna turn into gaslighting here. It's all in your head.
Yeah.
Like, no, please fix my broken arm. Thank you very much. So as we're moving forward, keep in mind that there are issues with the medical model, but that doesn't mean it has no value. You know?
Yeah, I think the whole thing is we are not trying to pick the best model.
Correct.
We are accepting the pros and cons of every model and how they all interact together.
Agreed. I couldn't agree more. But now we're going to get into kind of what you started to touch on a little bit, which is the social model.
Okay.
So the social model says people aren't disabled. Society disables people. Mm-hmm. So an easy metaphor is there's a person who uses a wheelchair and they need to get into a building, but there's a set of stairs. Yeah. So the medical models would say, well, okay, this person, for whatever reason, maybe their legs don't work so good, or they have not great balance, or they have some, you know, muscle weakness. So let's address that. And, you know, maybe after some medical intervention, they'll be able to walk up the stairs themselves. Mm-hmm. The social model says there's nothing wrong with the person using a wheelchair. The problem is that there's stairs instead of a ramp or an elevator. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what's really the issue here is the lack of accessibility. So the stairs, the physical environment is the thing that is currently disabling this person in a wheelchair. So the social model kind of, it talks about disability as a widespread social phenomenon. So it's not individual. And it kind of locates the cause or the root cause of disability outside of the body. It's something that is imposed on people by, you know, society or the society around them. So, you know, does that kind of make sense, the difference between the medical model and the social model?
Yeah, no, for sure. And amazing. I think it's very interesting to see how those two specifically interact.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting how kind of the default is usually the medical model.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, what does that say?
Yeah, it underpins so many different systems or institutions in society. So, you know, the example of the hospital, when the assumption there is that you are sick or there's something going on, and you would like the doctors, the nurses, the staff to make you better. Mm-hmm. And to be fair, that's true for a lot of people. Yeah. Lots of people, you know, don't hang out at hospitals just because they're fun places to be. But some of the issues with the medical model is that it's kind of an individualized view of disability. It can sometimes miss the societal or the systemic causes. There's a common metaphor that's used. You know, there's a river, and you know, you see someone, unfortunately, they come flowing down the river, and it looks like they're not swimming, they're drowning. So you jump in the river and you fish them out, and you say, you know, you good, what's up? And then you look out at the river again, and there's another person, unfortunately, being carried away by the current, who can't swim. So you jump in and you help them too. But this keeps happening, and you're so busy, you know, trying to save the individuals who are drowning in the river.
Where are these people coming from?
Precisely. What's happening upstream? Yeah. Why are all these people in the river?
Yeah.
So that's the social model typically, you know, gives you a better lens to analyze some of the wider structures at play and say, okay, so is the issue really that this person who is perhaps elderly and maybe they have less heat tolerance, is that the issue? Or is the issue that, like...
there aren't systems in place to prevent this.
Yeah, you know, if there's a heat dome, is the issue that there aren't cooling centers in their part of town, or the cooling centers aren't accessible, or they need assistance to get to the cooling centers, you know? Like, what's the root cause here?
The medical model definitely, I feel, tends to kind of pinpoint responsibility on the individual rather than look at the greater systems at play.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know we'll get into this a little bit more in some future episodes, but I also want to say the model of or the view of disability that you're using influences the language you choose to use when you talk about disability. So the medical model, there's more nuance to it, of course, but perhaps you might hear someone say a person with MS or in clinical care settings, you'll hear someone say a patient. And so they really, the emphasis is on the individual. We'll often hear lots of things about diagnoses. Although nowadays, you know, it's changed a little bit. So you might, instead of hearing, you know, someone say, oh, well, that's... pardon me. So nowadays, it's kind of merged a little bit with one of the other models that we'll talk about a little bit, the human rights model. And so it would be more common to hear someone say a person with. So still trying to center the person a little bit, but still adding on to the end there the diagnosis or the specific impairment at play. Versus the social model. The the social model, typically, you'll hear people using the social model say disabled and non-disabled. So because the source of disability is not seen as an individual failing or something that's centered in the individual, the idea is that there should be no shame in identifying as disabled. So saying, I am disabled, not because there's something wrong with me, but because the world around me isn't accessible. Doesn't try to accommodate.
And I think that the social model is important to, it's important to consider that disability is not a binary thing. It's not black and white. There are many shades of gray and people, it's very much so not like an able-bodied versus non-able-bodied person. It's very much so more of like what we talked about, what we touched on earlier, like everybody will identify technically or could identify as disabled at some point in their life. Mm-hmm. It's almost impossible to avoid.
Yeah.
Which is why the social model really comes in play, because there is absolutely no shame in the human body doing its own human body thing.
Exactly, yeah. Although people who, you know, haven't been introduced to the social model, that's where you'll tend to see miscommunication. So someone saying, you know, hi, my name is Sam and I am disabled. And someone else might say, oh, no, you're not disabled.
Yeah.
You're specially abled. You're okay.
Yeah.
And so you kind of get this weird, like, communication issue where someone's like, No. I am disabled, meaning everything around me needs to change, which is always an interesting interaction.
That's funny. One of my professors, she's like, yeah, like here I'm considered to be legally blind, but she was in the UK for 10 years doing work, and she was like, in the UK I'm hard of sight, which
interesting
was which is what they legally like labeled her as, and she was like, unfortunately I did not make my eyesight any better, but
exactly,
it was interesting to see that that was kind of the philosophy that they used over there.
That's a new one. I haven't heard that before. Very interesting. But actually the social model came out of a lot of work in the UK, kind of maybe 70s to 90s sort of.
Oh, that's recent.
Yeah. Actually, okay, this is an aside, but I was reading this paper this week for class, and it was published in, 1998. So yeah, it's kind of old, but it's not that old.
No, that's pretty recent.
And then the paper said, like, the newly emerging social model. And I was like, what?
It is absolutely bizarre how recent a lot of things really were.
Yeah, it blew my mind for a second. But anyways, kind of maybe, these two kind of ideas developed in similar sort of time frames. But another big one is the human rights model. Mm-hmm. So this is where you'll typically hear language that's often commonplace in Canada or in so-called Canada, which is a person with a disability. Mm-hmm. And so the idea being, okay, yes, someone has a disability, but they're still people. And so because oftentimes when someone has a disability, people, especially healthcare providers in some contexts, will pay attention to the disability and forget about the person.
Yeah.
And in this way of thinking, shouldn't it really, all be about the person who is at the center of all of this? And so this person first language, if you've ever heard, we encourage people to use person first language. That's what this is talking about. Some of the broader underpinnings of the human rights model are in the legal system, and specifically like the kind of what we would think of as the commonplace legal system in, Canada or perhaps the States, so Western type countries, because the human rights model is tied up with many battles or victories that have played out through the court system. So, in so-called Canada, the Constitution, says that you cannot discriminate based on, and then there's a list of, sometimes they're called protected categories or classes. Mm-hmm. And so physical or mental ability or disability, the wording might be slightly different, is one of them. And so that is a result of many, many legal issues and cases that have played out. And so that's kind of the broader context sort of to the human rights model.
I feel
model.
Like the human rights model kind of touches a little bit more on ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of reminds me of Hila. I think it was Hila. Actually, I want to fact check myself on this real quick. Hila cells, that's right. Hila cells. So basically, there was a person, Henrietta Lacks, a black woman, a black African-American woman who lived in the States, and she had cancer, and I believe her cells were harvested without her permission in the 80s or 70s. Mm-hmm. And this is when it was like, obviously it's incredibly unethical, but it wasn't technically illegal at the time.
Yeah.
And her cells proved to be very useful in doing a lot of research. Like, her cells were actually the first ones to successfully produce IVF results. And like, eventually cell harvesting without consent became illegal, as it should.
Yeah.
But Henrietta Lacks cells were still being used. And eventually a lot of these studies were published, and as a result a lot of DNA information was published. And that's where it gets kind of tricky, because jobs cannot discriminate on your, like, DNA information.
Yeah.
But life insurance can.
They absolutely can, yeah.
Which is, like, and there's this whole legal case in scientific ethics about like the family of Henrietta Lacks being like, mm-hmm. well, now my DNA information is out there and it was not consensually published. And
yeah.
It, by like Henrietta Lacks herself or by any of the family members. And like, it's so curious.
Yeah. And that is continuing to get more and more complicated these days. Mm-hmm. Data privacy is becoming, I think people or at least governments and institutions are paying more attention to it. As I know, actually, UBC is. There's a recent records management system and kind of updating how UBC protects and secures data. There was a recent report published on by the Office of the Information and Privacy Commissioner of BC that the report says that there are massive gaps right now in the way that the healthcare system protects people's data. People, so, you know, this is your personal health information. The interaction of data privacy and consent, and then as we're now moving into more and more a digital age, it is very, very complex. And I at least don't have the background to say what's going to happen or to comment too much. But it is going to be interesting to watch. Yeah.
Yeah. Ethics is, I mean, that's a whole other thing. But in terms of how we approach disability, I think being able to look at least these three core models, and obviously there are so many more, but the medical model, which is not perfect by any means, but it has its time and place.
Correct.
The human rights model, which is very important for how disability and accessibility operates within our society as we've created it. And then the social model, which is very important on just how we like kind of interact on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
And how we kind of want our society to structure around this concept of disability.
Absolutely.
But anyways, we're gonna go to break really quickly, and when we're back, we'll have some more chats.
Radio.
CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Happy. Boing.
Are you looking for ways to be a part of the community through low-stakes opportunities like volunteering? What about making friends that are really cool or have some common interests? Well, I'm here to tell you that at CITR, you can come volunteer at Volunteer Wednesdays, happening every other Wednesday from 12 to 3 with a really fun activity each time, like making signs or button making. Not only is it a great break from outside stress, but a great opportunity to be a part of the community. For more information, you can visit CITR's Instagram page at CITR and Discorder.
You know what I could go for right now? Authentic flour tortillas pan-fried until golden brown.
Yum!
Or vegan taco kits filled with traditional Mexican chilies and spices.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Or how about vegan potato and chorizo taquitos?
How can I get these foods immediately?
Buy Lita's Mexican Foods.
Sounds delicious. Tell me more.
Lita's Mexican Foods is a female-managed, plant-based Mexican food innovator in BC. Their products come prepackaged and frozen at tons of local grocery stores around Metro Vancouver. Not to mention they can be cooked in under 10 minutes.
Wow, that sounds perfect for me. I've been so busy lately and dinner takes so long to make. Where can I get my hands on some Lita's Mexican Foods?
Lots of places. Whole Foods, Choices, Stong's, Vegan Supply, Donald's, and even UBC Bookstore. Hey, where are you going?
To buy some Lita's Mexican Foods. See you later.
See ya.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to All Access Pass, brought to you by CITR 101.9 FM. So we just finished chit-chatting about three main models of disability: the medical model, the human rights model, and the social model. And we're going to talk a little bit just about some flaws within those models. So we talked, Sam and I already kind of chatted about like the limitations of the medical model. I feel like they're very obvious. They do pin a lot of responsibility on the individual. Mm-hmm. They just generally make individuals who identify as those with disabilities lives harder. Mm-hmm. But it does have its value.
Yes. Again, yeah. Going back to if you're in the emergency room for whatever reason, you don't want someone to come and tell you, it's okay, society is disabling you. You're like, no, my arm is broken and I'm bleeding. Please fix it.
Yeah, that reminds me of this. This is going to be so controversial. But, oh boy. I saw this, like, TikTok where this woman was, like, telling pregnant women to not drink during pregnancy is ableist because being disabled is not a bad thing. And fetal alcohol syndrome.
Yeah.
And I was like, disability is not a bad thing, but that is just such a weird take.
Yeah, it's a complex issue for sure because, I think on a very kind of logical basis, if there's a way to make people's lives easier, then we should do it. So if you're able to increase the chances of a child being born able-bodied, it would make sense that you should do that. But also, what message does public health campaigns, what message does it send to people with fetal alcohol syndrome?
Yeah,
because it's telling them that they're lesser than, that there's something wrong with them, that we should try to eliminate all the people like you. That's not kind.
No, it's not.
So it's a complex issue.
Complex topic that deserves a lot more than a TikTok. Anyways, so the medical model we've touched on. Let's talk about the flaws within the human rights model.
Yeah. So this is one that I learned a lot about last semester in my philosophy class. The class that wasn't a philosophy class, but was taught by a philosopher.
Okay.
So, which is the human rights model is really strongly tied to the legal system. Mm-hmm. But there are limitations in that. So within the legal system, typically to get rights, something bad has to happen to someone or to perhaps a group of people. And then those people and their lawyers have to get together. And this issue has to go up through the court system. Hopefully or presumably eventually to the Supreme Court of Canada, and they'll make a decision that then and the decisions could include changing laws, and then from that point on, those people who have that identity or who are part of that group then have rights. But that means before that legal battle kind of played out, they didn't have rights, which isn't, fantastic. And it also means that who's paying for that? Mm-hmm. So, lawyers aren't cheap. And so particularly when the people affected are members of a marginalized or oppressed group, they're less likely to have the monetary resources to battle this out through the legal system. So until that happens, legally and, within the human rights model, governments, institutions, people are allowed to discriminate based on whatever identity or group kind of identifier is at play. So the human rights model is limited because it kind of relies on the legal system. And so then you can get into all sorts of interesting conversations about what would a society or life look beyond the human rights model or beyond the legal system. And that is too much of a philosophical question for me to handle.
All right. Yeah. Let's get into like some flaws within the social model.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So this is, this debate plays out, I think it's got to happen at least once a week on someone's Instagram page or Reddit so it's very much still happening. A very valid criticism of the social model is that it can ignore people's lived experiences. Let's use chronic pain. So someone who lives with a condition, part of which is chronic pain. Excuse me. So the social model says there's nothing wrong with you. It's society that doesn't accommodate you. And this person who's living in chronic pain says, no, actually, there is something wrong. I'm living with this pain and I want it gone. Mm-hmm. And so the social model some people feel that it doesn't fully acknowledge their humanity or their experiences. Mm-hmm. And it can, some people, particularly in the earlier days, they actively discouraged people from, you know, talking about or publicly saying, you know, I want treatment, I want help, because they were worried it would weaken the social model. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, hopefully that's not too much of a, or so much of an issue these days, but you never know. But yeah, so that is a super valid criticism of the social model. And I need to stop because it takes way too much time. But every time I see this played out in some social media comments, I always tell them there are more. I usually leave a comment saying there are more than two models, because the two most well-known are the medical and the social. And my favorite model myself, and it is not perfect, but, you know, is the...
Is it really your favorite, Sam?
Clearly not, because I've lost the social relational model. There we go.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. There we go. So the social relational model, part of it has this idea of impairment effects, which are the inherent impacts or effects of the disability or of the impairment that cannot be accommodated away. So chronic pain. There are many things you can do to, you know, accommodate or to make life more accessible for people with chronic pain. But if chronic pain is an inherent part of that that illness or that disability, that's always going to be there. And so it gives a word for what people are often talk about as a criticism of the social model. And hopefully it also reminds people that there are more than two or even these three models. There are many models. And so to, you know, dive a little deeper rather than continuing the old, not age old, but the
it's not worn
out, the worn out argument of medical versus social.
I think it's,
we can
it's
be more creative.
I sound like I'm beating a dead horse, but it is incredibly nuanced. And I think in an ideal world, we would have options for anybody's choice and it would all be a very individual endeavor. But unfortunately, we are not quite there yet.
Not yet. And then quickly before I should also kind of point out one criticism of the social model, maybe less well known, is that it doesn't necessarily it may have a harder time recognizing and validating the experiences of people who have multiple marginalized identities. So, you know, a disability does not exist in a silo, or in the words of Audre Lorde, there is no such thing as a single issue struggle, because we do not live single issue lives.
Yeah.
So the social model, although I would add, depending how it's applied, can struggle to address the ways that, you know, not only does society disable people, but it disables different people differently based on, you know,
XYZ.
Yeah,
factors,
there are many,
race,
many different gender, you know, identities. Yeah.
Sexuality.
Yeah, exactly.
Intersectionality.
Yes.
I'd like to wrap up this episode by asking Sam how you identify.
Yeah, thank you for asking. Great question. I identify as disabled. Although that's been a recent kind of change in in my life. For a long time, I kind of thought of myself as a person with an impairment or a person with a diagnosis. But more recently, I have perhaps experienced some of that sort of societal or institutional kind of barriers put in place, and so that's been a transition in the way that I identify. And I'll toss it back at you, Nicole. How do you identify?
I literally just Googled, are mental illnesses considered disabilities? And okay, Google says persons with a mental health related disability are identified as those who experience limitations in their daily activities because of difficulties with an emotional, psychological, or mental health condition. And I think that very accurately kind of describes my personal relationship with considering myself and disability. I have never identified as being disabled. Doctors have identified me as mentally ill, and this is the whole person first language thing. I really hate being considered a quote-unquote mentally ill person. I've always preferred to be called a person who struggles with XYZ.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I don't think I've ever considered myself to be disabled, mostly because I am an incredibly high-functioning person. But recently I've been rethinking it because there are some accessibility factors that I do need.
Absolutely.
And I feel absolutely no shame in asking for them. So I've just kind of been like playing with that identity. And part of me is scared that by identifying, if I ever chose to identify as disabled, as someone who is incredibly high functioning and gets a lot done, would I be taking space away from someone who maybe is not necessarily as high functioning and productive as me, or would be considered socially as having more disability?
Yeah, that's it's a question that many people wrestle with. So just that makes a lot of sense, and you know, validating those feelings, especially as, I mean, we're all kind of university students, so exploring your identity is, isn't that what university is about?
Yeah, learning? Oh my gosh.
Never mind learning. Sorry.
No, for sure. Jokes, but, I feel like, once you kind of branch out more into the world, you're like, whoa, there are so many different things I can be or am.
Yeah.
And the real emphasis is on the can be, because I feel like once you are choosing to identify with something, can be both incredibly liberating, but also come with a lot of responsibilities.
And constraints, you know, because if you publicly identify as disabled, or tell someone that, people's expectations and stereotypes can be placed onto you, and so then people may expect more of you or expect less of you, or you know, all sorts of, depending on you know, the stereotypes at play. So it's it's a personal question. There's no right or wrong answer. And it's a life. It'll continue to change and evolve, I imagine, over your life.
I believe it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Anyways, thank you to everyone who tuned in for tuning in. Next week, we will be sitting down and kind of continuing on this language talk. Now that we've covered disability theory, we'll be getting a little bit more into the language we use, why we use it, why we use certain terms we do, and why we don't. And hopefully we'll be able to have some people who identify as disabled or non-able-bodied to come on and talk about their personal experiences with specific languages and why they choose to or don't choose to use certain words. Otherwise, have a good week, and you guys will hear from me next week. Bye.